Good evening. I'm calling this meeting of the Conference Committee on House File 1938 to order for Monday, May 8th. So today we're going to go over a few of the House positions that we just wanted to call people's attention to. Hopefully it won't take that long, and you know, we can kind of move through it quickly, and if people want to go to some party that might be happening, then they can make it. So with that, we're going to start by talking a little bit about our property tax division report. And you know, as you know, Chair Dave Lissegaard he undertook something that's really important, and that we all, as we were out campaigning this year, I think one of the top things that we heard from people was related to taxes was about property taxes. And we know that, you know, there's been a trend in the valuations in homesteads over the last couple years that have led to higher property tax bills for a lot of people, both homeowners and then renters who pay property taxes through their rent. And so Chair Lissegaard endeavored to kind of, he talked about it as peeling back the layers of the onion to both look at what were the drivers of some of these increases, and then what our policy response to that can be. And so, you know, I just wanted to highlight in the House position that we take a really strong position on property tax refunds. So there are three ways that we use property tax refunds, which, as probably most people in here know, are sort of our circuit breaker. So obviously local elected officials set property tax levies. We set classification rates, but we don't directly, as state legislators, we don't have the ability to lower people's property tax bills unilaterally. What we do have is the property tax refund, which is our circuit breaker and our way to introduce some income sensitivity to what is a regressive tax on the whole. So in the House's position on property tax refunds, first we have a special one-time targeted property tax refund, a one-time additional property tax refund payment. And so that's in the first biennium in 24-25. And it is $92.3 million, which would go to homeowners, homestead property taxes, and $32.3 million to renters. So we did a one-time property tax refund payment in part to respond to the trend that I identified at the beginning of my comments, which is sort of this increase in the homestead valuation and the subsequent increase in people's property tax bills. And so overall, in that one-time PTR payment, there's $124.6 million in that. We also do a special targeting PTR one-time payment. So property tax refunds in general are income sensitive because, as I said, the intent is to introduce some income sensitivity into what is a regressive tax type. So our special targeting PTR, the one-time payment, doesn't have an income limit. What it does is it says, you know, if somebody year over year sees a really dramatic increase in their property taxes, that we provide them a property tax refund. And so it's usually a 12% year over year increase, they get that refund. Under the House's position, if that year over year increase was 6%, then you would get a refund regardless of what your income is. That is $23.3 million in that bucket. And then finally, on the property tax refunds in the House position, you'll see that we reduce copays 5% for all recipients of property tax refunds. And so that's an ongoing investment in offsetting property tax bills for residents of Minnesota. So that is $41.8 million in fiscal years 24 and 25, and $84.9 million in fiscal years 26 and 27. So with those three items, the House position is to invest $275 million during the budget window in property tax refunds for Minnesotans who are struggling under these bills. And, you know, and that is something that was very important to our caucus. We heard about, as I said, we heard about property taxes almost every day out on the campaign trail. And we know that this is one of the tax types that people are most responsive to. And so we have $275 million over the budget window, and the Senate has $6.6 million over the budget window in property tax refunds. This is a major difference between our two bills, and we're really proud to bring forward a property tax division report that had this level of investment in this important tax cut for Minnesota residents. So the other big portion of our property tax division report, you know, because the property tax refunds deal with the individual side. And so they're the way that we can directly, you know, help taxpayers out with those bills. But the other, you know, equally important side of kind of controlling property taxes for Minnesotans has to do with our relationship with our local partners, with our cities and our counties. And the House takes a really strong position on LGA, CPA, and PILT. And we do that because we know that over time, we haven't kept up with our bargain. We haven't kept up with our commitments to our local partners, our commitments at the state level to help them provide the level of services that we know folks in our community need and expect. And so we're going to go over, if Mr. Swanson wouldn't mind, we're going to go over, there's this, what do you call this? This handout that he's going to present to us that everybody should have in their packets. That's about CPA, LGA, and PILT proposals in the House bill. And Mr. Swanson, please go ahead when you're ready.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Chair Rest.
Are copies of these made possible for the public to follow along?
Yes, there are also copies available in the area where there are handouts for the public. Thank you for that, Chair Rest. Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. Ms. Schill and I have been asked to give a little bit of background on county program aid, local government aid, and payment in lieu of taxes, as well as some of the House proposals in the tax bill related to these items. So as Chair Gomez said, there should be copies of some slides in the member packets. The slides have the title CPA, LGA, and PILT proposals. Slide two of that packet begins with county program aid, or CPA. So county program aid is a general purpose state aid that's available to all counties. Prior to 2004, aid to counties was paid under a number of different aid programs. In 2004, these were all consolidated into a single general aid. CPA distributes just under $265 million annually to all 87 counties. From 2005 on, county program aid has been allocated by two different formulas. So there's a need aid portion of the county program aid formula and a tax-based equalization aid portion. The amounts distributed under each portion of the formula were roughly equal through 2017. But since 2018, the amount distributed in the tax-based equalization aid portion of the aid has been about 25% greater than the need aid distribution. Each of these distribution formulas has different factors that determine the county's share of that total overall aid amount. Moving on to local government aid, or LGA, on slide four. LGA distributes just over $564 million annually to cities and is the largest source of general purpose state aid to cities. The history of the program dates back to 1976, when a portion of the newly enacted state sales tax was dedicated to local governments in order to provide property tax relief. This revenue sharing program switched to a general state aid program in 1971, and since then has gone through a number of changes, including many iterations of the formula used to distribute the funds. The last major reform in LGA occurred in 2013, and the current formula that distributes LGA is largely a result of the changes made that year. So each city's LGA is determined by calculating the city's unmet need. An unmet need within the LGA formula is the city's need, as determined by a formula, minus the city's ability to pay, which is the city's tax base multiplied by a statewide average city tax rate. And depending on a city's size, there are different factors that determine the city's need within the LGA formula. And again, the current factors that are used to determine need were last updated in 2013. Slide six just has a note about the uses of CPA and LGA. So as I've mentioned, both of these aid programs are a general purpose aid. There are no restrictions on how the aid can or cannot be spent, meaning aid can be spent on many of the same things that property taxes can be spent on, which is why these aid programs are often considered to be a form of property tax relief. Slide seven shows the changes in the House tax bill related to county program aid and local government aid. So the LGA changes include updating the factors that determine need within the LGA formula, increasing the appropriation by $100 million, and indexing that appropriation beginning with aids payable in 2026. The CPA changes include, again, increasing the appropriation by $100 million. That increase would be split proportionally between the need aid and tax-based equalization aid portions of the formula. The House tax bill would also index the county program aid appropriation again beginning in 2026. Madam Chair, now I believe Ms. Schill is going to talk a little bit about LGA and local revenues.
Moving back to the slide deck presentation, the next two slides on pages 9 and 10 of the slide deck presentation illustrate the most recent 20 years of local government aid as compared to state government, state general fund expenditures, and then compared to local non-school revenues. The sources of this data are two reports published by Minnesota Management and Budget and its predecessor,
Department of Finance. Thank you. Do I need to retract or did you hear that? We're all good. Okay. Good. Okay, its predecessor, Department of Finance, including end of session general fund forecast reports and price of government reports for the years 2002 and the year 2022. Section A of this table, and look at that part above the line on page 9, compares LGA appropriations relative to state general fund expenditures. In 2002, state general fund spending totaled $13.8 billion. Of that amount, appropriations for LGA were just under $565 million, or about 4.1%. In 2022, state general fund expenditures grew to $27.3 billion, an increase of 98%. And of that amount, LGA appropriations were just under $565 million, or about 2.1%. Now, Section B of the table, the part below that line, summarizes local non-school tax revenues, property taxes, local sales taxes, and other taxes during that same 20-year period, with property taxes as the primary source of local government funding. Note that these taxes grew by 147%, 644%, and 149%, respectively. This information is easier to understand in graph form, which you'll see on the next slide. So if you flip to page 10, this bar chart shows illustrations, once again, over a 20-year period of local non-school revenues for fiscal years 2003 and then 2023. Included here are both tax and non-tax resources. The blue or the dark bars, depending if you have color or gray slides, the blue bars represent revenues from 2003. The orange bars, or the light bars, are revenues for 2023. The top three sets of bars show other revenues, sales tax revenues, and property tax revenues. And as I mentioned previously, the growth in revenues for each of these taxes is 149%, 644%, and 147%. So if you look at the bars, you can see the variations along, and property taxes are the main driver. The remaining bar sets, like below those three sets, are local non-tax revenues, including enterprise revenues, investment earnings, charges for services, license and permits, and special assessments. And of these revenue sources, notable increases are attributed to charges for services at 103% and enterprise revenues for 131%. So it shows in the overall how local government revenues have grown and how LGA has not grown. That concludes the LGA presentation. I'll turn it back to Mr. Swanson for the PILT presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Go ahead, Mr. Swanson, when you're ready.
Madam Chair and members, the House Tax Bill also makes changes to the Payment in Lieu of Tax, or PILT, program for certain natural resources land within counties. Slide 12 in the handout shows PILT payment amounts and acreage for each type of land for which counties can receive payment, and this slide shows those payment amounts that are under current law. You can see at the top of the table that for three types of land, counties have an option to receive either $5.133 per acre or 0.75% times the value of the land. For other types of PILT land, counties receive a flat dollar amount per acre. And as you see in the table, those amounts range from $2 per acre up to $5.133 per acre. The last column in that table also shows the proportion of each type of land as a percentage of the total overall PILT acreage in the state. Slides 13 and 14, the last two slides in the handout, show the House PILT proposal changes summarized into two slides. So first, the House bill would change from $2 per acre to $3 per acre, the payment for county-administered other natural resources land and DNR-administered other natural resources land. So these are the bottom two rows on this table on slide 12. The House tax bill would also establish two additional PILT payment amounts. So an 18 cents per acre of PILT land for counties with PILT land comprising at least 25% of the total overall acreage within the county is established. And there's also an additional payment of 8 cents per acre of PILT land for counties with PILT land comprising 10 to 25% of the total acreage within the county. Lastly, the bill would prevent the appraised value of acquired natural resources land from decreasing from one appraisal to the next. It would index to inflation the PILT payment amounts. So these would be all of the dollar amounts that are seen on the payment amount column on slide 12, as well as the two additional PILT payment amounts that I mentioned are established in the bill. And lastly, the House tax bill would require the Commissioner of Revenue, in consultation with the DNR and counties, to produce a report on the valuation methods used for shoreline areas within other natural resources land. And a copy of that report would be delivered to the tax committees by January 31st, 2025. And Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of the slides.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Chair Lissegaard, did you have anything you wanted to add before we move on?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me begin by saying everybody around this table that I believe their heart is in the right spot and they want to help people. When I was asked to, I was given the honor to be the chair of property taxes, I took that to heart because I heard that on the doors, like many of you. And when it comes to local government aid and CPA, I remember, the advocates, the cities, and others come to me, and I said, you know, we're going to have one bill. We're going to have one bill because we're not going to be fighting against each other to improve lives. at a county level, at a city level, people are being taxed out of their homes. And this is one of the levers that we can do to help our partners. We ask our partners to do an awful lot at the county and the city. And we are falling behind in giving them the resources to meet the needs of the people they serve and we serve. And I just want to go back to the comment that was made. In 2002, local government aid represented 4.1% of the state budget. And today, it's 2.1%. And the mandates and the ask from us to the cities and the counties is growing exponentially. And we're not helping them. This is a document that I'm proud to stand behind. And I think that we need to help people stay in their homes. We need to help cities and counties provide the services that we put forth. And that's what this document does. And I hope as this committee continues to go, we really find it in ourselves to see what we're here to do. And what did we hear on the doors? Actions speak louder than words. And this document that we're presenting, I believe, is a major step in the right direction to helping people in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chair Lissagard. So before we move on from the property tax division report, I just wanted to draw folks' attention to a few other items that are in the House position. So we have a doubling of the homelessness aid to counties. That's on page 10, line 78. It goes up from to 40 million a biennium from 20, where it is right now. Or it goes up 40 million a biennium, which means that it will be 80 million a biennium on top of what it is right now. We also have a new affordable housing aid that goes to cities, counties, and tribal nations. That's 100 million in fiscals 24-25, 70 million in 26-27. You can find that on page 10, line 79 to 83. Finally, we have a new tribal nation aid, an ongoing aid that recognizes what our tribal, the services that our tribal nations deliver to their members and to other Minnesota residents that live near their reservations. And that is 75 million a year, 150 million a biennium. You can find that on page 11, line 101. And my apologies that I didn't orient us when we were talking about the property tax refunds. You can find those on page 7, starting on line 9, and that will give you kind of a picture of the two positions that we have there. And I just wanted to share quickly about those property tax refunds. When you're talking about homeowner property tax refunds, 45% of those go to seniors and those with disabilities. When you're talking about the renter's credit, one-third of people who claim that credit are seniors or those with disabilities. And so this is really a way that we are able to help folks who are struggling out with the cost of their lives. And I think if you take our position on property tax refunds and you take our position on support for local and tribal governments, then we really have a way to to help reduce costs for Minnesotans, especially for those who are who need it the most. And so we have a few more items. We're going to switch now to out of property taxes. Well, sort of. We have our transitional item, which is the House position changes the property tax refund for renters to a refundable income tax credit. And I'm just going to pass it over to Mr. Williams to share with us a little bit about that proposal. We don't have a slide deck for it, but Mr. Williams, please go ahead.
Chair Gomez and members, the House position on the renter's credit is that the credit would be converted from a standalone form filed and typically paid in August to a refundable income tax that would be filed as part of the income tax return. The proposal also converts the measure of income used from the credit from the broader kind of household income that includes certain types of non-taxable income And converts it to adjusted gross income, which is similar to how other tax credits in the existing tax code are phased out. The calculation of the credit under the House position doesn't particularly change. It's the same as it is under current law in terms of the amounts that individuals would receive. So it's mostly the timing and administration. There are two policy positions in that article that are new. The article requires the Department of Revenue to develop a simplified form. So under current law, because that's filed separately, people that don't have an income tax filing requirement can still file for a property tax refund or a renter's credit. So the House position sort of allows people who don't have a filing requirement to sort of, the Department of Revenue would set up a separate form for people that don't have an income tax filing requirement to sort of go and claim the renter's credit. There's also an appropriation in the House article, the 8th, which is the renter's credit article. It's $3.94 million in fiscal 24 and 25. For tax credit outreach. This would be for additional money provided to taxpayer assistance sites and other community groups, both to help people file and claim the credit, given the new kind of changes in the timing of the credit, and also to sort of promote the availability of the credit and now that it's being administered differently. The House bill is effective for tax year 2024, so those are income tax returns filed in 2025. If you look at the spreadsheet, the sort of effect of that is it jumps the fiscal year line. So in fiscal year 2025, there will be two payments. There will be the August payment in 2024, and then a second payment in April 2025 as part of the income tax form. And that's the House position on the renter's credit.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. So I just wanted to add one more thing that I found really compelling about this policy change. And so if you've ever, if you've filed a renter's rebate, you have to wait to get a certificate of rent paid from your landlord, and then you have to, download or otherwise get your hands on a paper form and do, fill it out. You can't do it till August, or you won't get your money till August, that is. And so it kind of creates some barriers to participation. And when the department did their analysis of this policy proposal of switching from a freestanding property tax refund for renters with the separate form and having to wait for your landlord, and when we pull it onto the income tax form, they estimate that 119,000 renters who are currently eligible today but are not claiming their rebate will participate in the program. And so, again, these are our lowest income Minnesotans who really, especially in the face of rising housing costs, which is impacting every community from border to border, we're really excited about this proposal because just kind of adding this simplicity and the efficiency of switching it onto an income tax form makes it accessible to those almost 120,000 Minnesotans who really could use the help. So we just have a couple more items. So on page 1, line 22 and 23, well, I guess it's 21, 22, 23, because we each have sort of different positions on it. But we're looking at 22 and 23, which are the House and Senate positions on the one-time rebate. I just wanted to highlight the differences there. So the House position is that $275 a person. So if you're a single, you're eligible for $275. If you're a married couple, you're eligible for $550. We also include $275 per dependent up to three dependents. The Senate bill, the Senate credit is $279 for singles, $558 for married joint, and $56 per dependent up to three dependents. They have the same phase out, which is a cliff at $150,000 for a married couple. But your maximum credit for a family of five under the House position is $1,375. Your maximum credit for a family of five under the Senate position is $726. Obviously, ours costs, a little bit more. So, but that's the difference in the positions there. The last item that I wanted to discuss is the working family tax credit and child tax credit position that the House has. And again, I'll just ask Mr. Williams to go over the handout that we all received and is available in the public area with handouts. So whenever you're ready, Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and members, I'll be working from this document that's labeled House, Child, and Working Family Credit Proposal. So as was discussed during the walkthrough, the House position is a sort of to convert the existing working family credit into a two-part credit. There's a credit of up to $500 based on the taxpayer's earned income and a separate credit of $1,275 per child. There's no cap in the House position on the number of eligible children. Both the earned income credit and the child credit would be phased out jointly, so they'd be phased out as sort of in one amount. There's one phase-out threshold for both of them, which is $36,000 for a married joint filer and $28,000 for a single filer. Chair Gomez requested some modeling from the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia University for this proposal, and that modeling estimates that the House bill will reduce child poverty by 26.2%. as compared to 14.4% in the Senate bill. Some other changes that are in the House position here are allowing taxpayers who file with an individual taxpayer identification number to claim the credit. That's also in the Senate position. The credit is also allowed in the House position for childless filers who are 18 or 65 and older. Those individuals are permitted under federal law from claiming the earned income credit, which also prohibits them from claiming the state credit, the state working family credit. The House position also contains permissive language, allowing the Commissioner of Revenue to set up a process for making advance payments of the credit. Chair Gomez asked me to talk a little bit about the ways that the new credit is structured. So under current law, there are essentially four credit rates, depending on your filing status. And under the House position, the same credit rate and the same amount of earned income would be eligible for the earned income portion of the credit. That's on page, there's a table there on page four that shows you this. If you turn to page 5, you can also see how the maximum credit under the House position increases relative to current law. So one thing that's unique to the House position is that childless filers would see an increase in their maximum credit from $316 to $500. And you can see how the credit would scale sort of depending on the number of children that you have. On page 6 of the slides, you can see the changes in phase-out thresholds. So under current law, there's actually 8 different phase-out thresholds for the working family credit. And the bill simplifies the credit calculation by converting that to 2 phase-outs, just one for married joint filers and one for single filers. And similarly, on page 7, you can see that there's 3 phase-out rates that apply to different taxpayers depending on their filing status. And in the House omnibus bill, the phase-out rate is 9% for all filers. On slide 8, Chair Gomez asked me to talk briefly about the issue of effective marginal tax rates in the House and Senate positions. So, a marginal tax rate, it measures the change in your income tax paid or the reduction in the credits that you receive for each additional $1 of income. So essentially, how does $1 of additional income affect your financial situation? That's different from than the average tax rate, which is just sort of how much that's sort of either your total tax paid or your total credit received as a portion of your total income. Most credit recipients for these credits would probably have negative average tax rates under current law because they don't pay income tax and they receive refundable credits. But under current law, taxpayers that are in the phase-out range for these have high marginal tax rates. That means that when their income goes up, they may be subject to the state income tax, the federal income tax, and then the phase-outs for these credits. And one thing to sort of wrap your mind around is that tax credit phase-outs are mathematically equivalent to taxes in terms of the outcome for an individual. So, for example, the House tax credit or child tax credit is phased out at 9%. That means an additional $1,000 of income would reduce your child credit by $90. And that's sort of the same change in your financial position as if you just tax that $1,000 at 9%. So phase-outs of credits are mathematically equal to taxing income over the same range. On page 9 of the slides, you can see that the Senate and House positions are different in terms of the marginal tax rates that they impose on different ranges of income. So under the House position, for married joint filers with 2 kids, the highest effective marginal tax rate is 47.4%, which means it's around $50,000 or so. taxpayers who earn an additional $1,000 of income only would see sort of their net income increase by 53% or so. The Senate bill, because it layers an additional phase out on top of the existing phase out, and you can kind of see it visually in this graph. So there's the federal brackets, which do come into effect about $30,000 for people who have two kids and claim the standard deduction. There's the federal earned income credit phase out. There's Minnesota tax brackets. There's the existing working family credit phase out. A little bit higher up is the dependent care credit, although that's changing in the Senate position. And then there's also the Senate child credit phase out layered on top. So people that are in that phase out range can face effective marginal tax rates as high as 55.1% or 11%. And Chair Gomez asked me to prepare a memo on this topic, sort of describing this policy. And you know, one other thing that she asked me to mention is that same income range where there's high effective marginal tax rates, that what's discussed in the slides there only really mentions the tax component of this. So there's also a number of public programs that are being phased out over that range, and people are losing public benefits as their incomes go up over that range. And so if you look at the memo, there's a graph showing for a married couple with two children, for example, in the $40,000 to $65,000 range of income, those people actually already have marginal tax rates in excess of 100%. And so it's sort of a policy consideration for the conference committee to think about imposing additional high marginal tax rates over income in that range, because it sort of means that if the taxpayer's income goes up, if they earn more, if they get a promotion, they seek more training, they might not see much change in their net financial position because they're in these sort of phase-out ranges. So that concludes the discussion of the House Child Credit proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. So everyone should have been provided with a memo dated May 3rd, 2023. This comes from the Columbia Center on Poverty and Social Poverty and Social Policy, and it estimates the relative poverty reductions under the House and Senate child tax proposals. So as you can see, there's just a little chart in there. The Senate proposal would lower child poverty by 14.4%, and the House proposal would lower child poverty by 26.2%. So we appreciate them doing that analysis for us. So we're really proud of the work that we've done on the Working Family and Child Tax Credit. It greatly simplifies the credit. We go from 8 phase outs to 3. It doesn't increase marginal rates on people who are in those phase outs. It removes the cap on the number of children who are eligible for the tax credit, which we think is really important to a lot of Minnesotans who have larger families. Also, our approach on the Working Family Credit increases refunds for those without children. It includes 18-year-olds and 65-plus-year-olds who are, even if they're eligible and they have dependents currently, are not allowed to claim the tax. And, you know, that bigger poverty reduction that we get, the 14 versus more than 26%, is at the same price. And so, we appreciate the opportunity to go a little bit deeper into some of these proposals in our bill that are really important to us. You know, we're really proud of our tax bill that we put together in the House. It's comprehensive. It helps Minnesotans who need it the most. It really focuses the resources that we have on those who need a little bit of extra cash in their pockets. And it's a balanced bill that works, and we look forward to more conversation about it. And with the Senate has the gavel tomorrow, and with that,
Chair,
we are, yes.
Could I just give a brief response here?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Chair Rest.
Thank you very much. The Senate will have a more formal response to the presentation you've made today. But I want to tell you how really enthusiastic I am about making the change on the renter's credit, which was Representative Marquardt's provision, and which the conference committee last year was really primed to accept. So you're going to find lots and lots of interest on the part of the Senate for the change in the renter's credit. In terms of the comparisons just ordinarily between the two bills, keep in mind that the House raised $1 billion more in taxes and had more opportunities to do good things are in the direction of the goals that all of us have. Our tax increase was far more modest, even though $1 billion doesn't seem to be modest at all. But we tomorrow are going to we're going to talk about the renter's credit because it's on our agenda. We're very enthusiastic about it. We're going to work hard to raise the money to pay for it. We're going to bring up the same and similars that we had from last week. We're going to talk about 4D. We're going to talk about the individual provisions in TIF. We have been having conversations, because it wasn't in our bill, with the tribes and with the charities about a good resolution to the challenges of pull tabs. We're going to talk about public safety aid. We're going to talk about the entire set of aids that are provided toward local governments, and not just CPA and LGA. Those are two silos that we feel we need to be looking at a much broader total of aids. And we're also going to be looking at, as much as we can identify, similar aids that are being offered in other bills, so that we can avoid some duplications. But we really appreciate once again the work of the conference committee last year. It's too bad, and we did have a bill that moved also the homeowners property tax refund into the current biennium, but it is extraordinarily, as you might imagine, extraordinarily expensive. But my opinion, and I think it's shared by my conferees, if not, they'll tell me, that we should not squander this opportunity to move the renter's credit into the current fiscal year. And I, for one, am going to work very, very hard to get the House to accept their own provision. Okay, think about it, and that we have enough revenues that we can make that a priority. So thank you for letting me have that brief response, and we'll be analyzing the choices and the preferences that were made in the House, with far more revenues to do it, and I'm not sure that we wouldn't be much closer in comparisons. We too are very, very proud of the bill that we passed almost on a shoestring, in terms of giving aid in property taxes and in the governor's priorities and so forth. And I think we're all on the same path here. We just have to decide what our resources are reasonable and going forward. I have indicated certainly between $2 billion and $1 billion in tax increases, there's a lot of room in between to meet the goals that both the House and the Senate are intent on. And I appreciate the information you've presented, and we'll have another response on that as well. I mentioned pull tabs, which we're very interested in. You know, we didn't take that up in our bill, but we do think it is a challenging issue for the legislature that we should address. And also, we've been working with Senator Weber on the challenge of Wyndham, which I think you're familiar with, a city in his area that where a pork producing plant is closing down, looking for another buyer. but we're working with the leadership to make sure that that's not going to have an overwhelming deleterious impact on that city, and with 1,000 workers and I think just a 4,000 person population. So they're going to be in some straits, and we hope that the House will join us in reaching out to the city of Windham and considering ways in which we can mitigate harmful effects that are going to come there, even though it's in currently there's no provision in either bill. But we'll keep you apprised of that and so forth. But thank you very much. And that's going to be our agenda for tomorrow. We will hear more about the renter's credit and some of the other issues that I just identified and talking about what our agenda will be tomorrow.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair Rest. Glad to hear that we have a shared commitment to doing this renter's credit transition. That's great news. And we looked at the homestead credit, too, and it's like it's a very hefty first biennium.
Cost too much.
cost. So with that, we're meeting tomorrow, May 6th. The Senate has the gavel, and we are adjourned.
It's the night.